Hello, you're listening to a special podcast recorded at the 2013 British Humanist Association Conference in Leeds. This podcast was brought to you by The Pod Delusion, a weekly news magazine, radio programme and podcast about interesting things. From politics to culture to science, we look at all of these from a rationalist, humanist perspective. You can find out more about The Pod Delusion and listen to our weekly programme at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, in this podcast, we're going to hear from Marek Kukula, who's the public astronomer at the Greenwich Observatory. In his talk, he explains how the world around us has been shaped by events in space and how life on Earth has adapted to survive them. So here's Marek with more.
Yes, the mic in the right position. Good. If I'm too quiet, just let me know. That doesn't happen very often. I'm here today to talk to you about the Earth and its connection with space. Normally, I talk about space as stuff that's right out there, but I think we shouldn't forget that we are part of the universe and everything down here on Earth is affected in some way or another by stuff going on out there, either right now or long ago in the past. And there's all sorts of ways that it's connected. Some of it is in very, very fundamental ways. The mathematics, the forces, the laws of nature that govern things out in space are the same laws of nature that govern things here on Earth. And often the way we understand things out there is by trying to understand things here. We can't use the universe as a laboratory because we can't go there, or at least we can only explore a tiny part of it. So a lot of what we know is based on experiments that we can do here on Earth. So I want to talk to you today about the ways in which the Earth is directly connected to stuff out there. We're not separate, we're not isolated from the rest of the universe, we are part of it. But I want to, first of all, thank the BHA for inviting me. I know they didn't have any free will, as Sue's just explained, but that very complex, highly evolved mental and physical machinery that is our bodies and brains, I think has made a very smart decision, so thank you very much. This was my inspiration, I suppose, that made me at least choose to be an astronomer again, perhaps not a free decision, but it kind of went into all of that processing, and that's how I ended up. Another inspiration, actually, was the Clangers when I was a child. And I've actually bought five for my nieces and nephew, so I won't be throwing them out to the audience today. But that's where I started, and that's where I spent 3 years of my life doing my PhD. But I moved, not away from radio astronomy, but I broadened my horizons, and I spent a lot of time working with the Hubble Space Telescope, which of course looks at optical and infrared light rather than radio emission. Now, just a little bit about where I come from, where I work now. I'm at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich. Probably many of you went as a child and you stood on the meridian line, 1 foot in the east, 1 in the west, and maybe looked at some dusty old telescopes in a display case. Certainly what I did. If you haven't been for a few years, please, please come back. We're much bigger, much better now. We still have all the historic stuff. We still have the meridian line. That's not going to go away. But we're now a modern science centre as well, and we have loads of really cool stuff about the universe and also London's only planetarium, which is this thing here, this really ultra-modern bronze structure. So it's a really fun place. And myself and the other 5 astronomers there, we love talking about space. So we're always happy to tell people about the latest discoveries. So please, please do come. And also, I have to say this bit of an advert, but it opened yesterday. I've spent the last 6 months of my life working on this massive new exhibition in a neighbouring building at the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich called Visions of the Universe. I'm very pleased with it. It's 100 beautiful images, animations, projections of things in space, some of them quite modern, some of them quite historic images. There's a lot of science in the exhibition, of course there is. I'm a scientist, I'm a science communicator. I love talking about science. But also, these are beautiful images, and inspiration really is key to this exhibition and key to what we try to do at the Royal Observatory, because I don't think of science as being something that's separate and apart from the rest of human culture. It is completely part of human culture and embedded in everything else that we do. So really, really beautiful pictures, including, and this is the thing I'm most pleased with, the Mars window. We've projected panoramic high-definition images from NASA's 3 most recent Mars rovers onto a 13 by 4 metre curved wall. And the NASA scientists that we worked with when we first switched it on last week, they stood in front of it quite emotional because they'd been studying these pictures on their computer screens for years, but for the first time they felt they were actually standing there. It really is very, very cool. Please do come. But because we're also interested in beauty, we have art in the exhibition. We have some pictures by Wolfgang Tillmans, who you may know won the Turner Prize a few years ago. And he happens to be a massive astronomy geek, so he's loaned us some of his really beautiful astronomical photography for free. And we've also got a programme of events that discusses astronomy in the context of the broader culture. So we've got poets like Simon Barraclough, who's written poetry about space. And also we'll be discussing people like Rebecca Elson and Pippa Goldschmidt, who were astronomers who've written respectively poetry and novels about their science. So all sorts of stuff going on. I will actually talk about what I came here to talk about now. This is the Royal Observatory in Greenwich Park. Very, very beautiful. Christopher Wren building, 1675. And of course, Greenwich Park is a very lovely place. If you've been, we have deer, we have ducks and geese and swans, we have a lot of squirrels, quite scarily unafraid squirrels, actually. And they live in Greenwich Park. And Greenwich Park is a very beautiful place. It changes through the seasons. Here's the, sort of the natural world in Greenwich Park. We've got winter, we've got spring, we've got lovely cherry blossom. It is a gorgeous place. But Greenwich Park, if you can see this, Greenwich Park is about here. It is, of course, an island of green surrounded by the urban, uber-urban environment of London. But, of course, London itself is an urban island in the leafy home counties. And Britain itself is not isolated from the rest of the world's environment. Our weather, we're very well aware, often comes in from the Atlantic, so we get a lot of stuff from the west. But what happens in the rest of the world affects us here in Britain. We can't separate ourselves. And here we go. Here is the whole planet. And it's very beautiful, but it's constantly changing, constantly moving. So everything on Earth is affected by everything else on Earth. And of course, the Earth, as I say, is not isolated from the rest of the universe. This is how we appear from Earth orbit, or close to Earth orbit. This actually was a... Can you see the moon there? Just about see it? Probably not, actually. Can we have the... Is it possible to take the lights down at all? Maybe not. Most of my pictures are quite dark because they're of space. I'll carry on anyway. Oh, that's better. That's much better. Brilliant. Can you see the moon? So this picture, really beautiful. Once one of my favourite space pictures was taken by a spacecraft back in the 90s called Galileo. And Galileo, from the name, as you might expect, it was designed to study Jupiter. But this is a picture it took really to test its cameras as it did a flyby of the Earth on its way to the outer solar system. And I love it because it shows you so much that's special about the Earth. Here it is with its companion, the Moon. These two objects are made of the same material. They formed at the same distance from the Sun. They receive the same amount of radiation from the Sun, and yet they are very different. The Moon was too small to hold on to its atmosphere, any atmosphere it may have had. It's now barren and airless. The Earth, with its comfortable blanket of air, trapping the heat from the Sun, it's got exactly the right temperature and pressure to have liquid water, two-thirds of it covered in liquid water, completely unique in the solar system. And the water evaporates, it rains onto the land, and you can see down the coast of South America here that green colour, which is chlorophyll, of course, the pigment in plants that enables them to capture sunlight, turn it into food, capture that energy. And, of course, the plants themselves in that process pump oxygen out into the atmosphere, changing the composition of the atmosphere. And if this picture had been taken a few hours earlier, this part of the Earth would have been in darkness, and you would have seen all down the coast of South America the lights of our cities. So there's another species on Earth which is changing the atmosphere, because those lights are powered by electricity, much of it produced by burning fossil fuel, which is also, of course, changing our atmosphere in ways that we don't understand. And I'll show you in a minute why, of course, we should feel quite bad about that, but it's not the first time life on Earth has done something catastrophic to the atmosphere. Now, this is how we appear from Mars. We have a fleet of spacecraft there right now, several in orbit, two active on the surface, and several dead ones as well, kind of floating around or sitting on the surface. One of them was commanded to turn its camera, rather than at Mars, to turn around and point back at the Earth. And this is what we look like through a bit of a telescope from Mars. Again, you can see the Moon, you can see the Earth. And even from Mars, you can tell that the Earth is special, because that shiny patch is sunlight reflecting off the Pacific Ocean. So you can see through a reasonable telescope on Mars that the Earth has oceans of liquid water. And this... what I'm going to show you next, I think, is one of the most important photographs ever taken. and it's rubbish. It was taken by Voyager a few years ago now, but still way, way out on the edges of the solar system, commanded to turn its cameras back home. And this is the famous pale blue dot picture. This is what the Earth looks like from the edge of the solar system. And Carl Sagan, that great popularizer of science, said very famously at the time, look at that pale blue dot. Everyone you've ever met, everyone you ever heard of lived there. That is all of us. It is that if you were alive in the 90s, that you're in that picture somewhere. Which is really amazing, really quite humbling, but also at the same time, we can build machines that can go out there and take those pictures and send them back. I think that's pretty amazing. Now, this is, I actually grew up not far from here, just a little bit down the M1 in South Yorkshire, and this is a picture of a field quite close to my parents' house. And in Britain, when we think of nature and the natural world, this is probably what we think of. But of course, that's a completely artificial environment. If there were no human beings in the British Isles, the landscape, certainly in this part of the world, would be dominated by these guys, sort of the oak trees, the ash trees. And all of this stuff, these meadow plants, would be confined to small natural clearings. And of course, we've completely tipped the balance the other way, because that kind of landscape suits these guys that we like to live with, the cows, the sheep, that kind of thing, because we use them for all sorts of things, for food, for milk, for hide, for wool, all of those things. So we've changed the environment because it suits us and it suits them. But I do want to remind you that there are many, many environments on the Earth, many natural environments. I'm a big science fiction fan, but I do always get a little bit, well, I don't get annoyed, but I laugh a bit when you see them going to the desert planet or the ice planet or the jungle planet or whatever. I hope in the next few years we'll discover other planets that have biospheres like the Earth. My prediction is that they will be just as varied and diverse as ours is. And here are some of those varied biomes on the Earth. You've got mountain forests, you've got deserts, which of course can be very rich with life. Rainforest, incredibly rich environment. The ice deserts of the poles under this ice, of course, very rich marine environments. Another grassland, this time a very natural one, and probably our own natural environment where we evolved, the savannas of Africa. Mountains, and of course, two-thirds of the Earth covered in oceans, very diverse biomes in the oceans there. And we've discovered in the last few decades that there is life in some really weird places, so hot springs, really extreme heat and acidic or alkaline environments. Here's some little mossy stuff growing in cracks in the ice in Antarctica. Only really lives for a few days a year when the temperatures come up enough, and the rest of the time it's completely dormant. These black smokers deep in the ocean, ecosystems pretty much independent from the sunlight, which powers most life on Earth. And even just in the last few months, we've heard of drilling down into these lakes under the ice in Antarctica and finding that there are things living down there as well. So life is pretty adaptable and can live in some quite extreme conditions. But let's just go back to school. I promise this is the hardest slide. I'm not saying that you can't cope with it, but on a Saturday it's hard for me to cope with hard science. Requirements for life. We think it needs an energy source, and most life on Earth, ultimately the energy source is the sun. If we don't make food from the sun ourselves, we probably eat something that has, or that has eaten something that has. But of course, there are environments on the Earth where the energy source is something different. This is the chemical energy, chemicals dissolved in the superheated water that is the basis for that ecosystem. Liquid water, we think, seems to be essential as a kind of a solvent for living things. And I've included the sort of the chemical makeup of it because we'll be asking questions a bit later on about where these atoms, these elements came from. And then organic chemicals, and I think you heard this morning, I unfortunately missed Lee's talk, but that we know that life on Earth needs organic chemicals. We don't know whether that's the only way you can have comparable systems of organized chemistry, but at the moment on Earth, that's what we have here, and that's what most astrobiologists are looking for elsewhere. And of course, this is probably the most famous organic molecule, the DNA molecule. But there's also things like alcohol is an organic molecule. Where did it all come from? Well, of course, it all came from the Big Bang. I've been saying for the last 10 years, 13.7 billion years ago. We now know, just in the last few months, it's actually more like 13.8 billion years ago, so the universe has got slightly older. But the Big Bang didn't make most of the atoms in the universe. The Big Bang made a lot of hydrogen, some helium, a tiny amount of lithium, and that is all. So where did all the other elements in the periodic table come from? And, you know, you can't make planets out of hydrogen and helium. Even the gas giant planets in our solar system have something a bit denser in their centre to hold all of that hydrogen and helium in place. You certainly can't make the Earth, and you can't make living things with just hydrogen and helium. So where did it all come from? And the answer, of course, is the stars. I'm sure most of you knew that already. Most of the chemical elements were cooked up inside generation after generation of stars. And here you go. Here's a star. And deep down in the centre, the temperatures and pressures are so great that you can take simple chemical elements like hydrogen and you can crush them together. And instead of bouncing off like they would normally do, in those temperatures and pressures, they stick together and form heavier elements and release energy when they do. And it's that energy which causes the star to shine. So that's really what's going on. And as the star goes through its life, you can, depending on how big the star is, it will fuse hydrogen into helium, you'll form carbon, you'll form oxygen, neon, magnesium, silicon, you can form all sorts of things down to iron. Well, that's all very nice, but all this stuff is stuck inside a star. How does it get back out into the universe where it might be useful for making planets and making people? Well, of course, stars don't live forever, and with our telescopes, we have a pretty good idea of what happens to stars when they reach the end of their nuclear fusion stage. And a star like the Sun, or a bit more massive than the Sun, will eventually do something like this. It will gently, over thousands of years, expel most of its outer layers back into space and form this very, very beautiful, what we call a planetary nebula. It's nothing to do with planets. But all of these colours that you can see in this Hubble image, they are showing you where different types of chemical element are. So the material that the star, as it dies, returns to the universe is enriched with new chemical elements. And here are some beautiful pictures of planetary nebulae. They have all these strange, wonderful shapes. We still don't fully understand why there's such a variety of shapes, why stars can die in apparently so many different, or at least create so many different structures as they undergo a fundamentally similar process. But in these images, some of them quite false colour, some of them more real colour, as you'd see it with your eyes, the colours are there telling you about different chemical elements that have been produced inside the star. Now, stars like the Sun, and slightly bigger than the Sun, can produce inside them all of the elements up to iron. And iron is the most stable element in terms of nuclear physics. When you try to fuse iron together, you can do it. You can crush iron nuclei together and stick them together into heavier things. That process actually takes in energy, it doesn't give it out. And when you do that, the star becomes unstable because it's not generating energy in its heart. It can't support itself against gravity. The inside part of the star collapses and a shockwave blasts the outer parts of the star away. And I actually have a movie here. This is what we call a supernova. So this is stars much larger, more massive than the Sun. And it's just fun. Bang. And in that explosion, more elements are generated. That material forced quite violently back out into the universe. And there it goes. And so in these explosions, these supernova explosions, only a very small subset of the most massive stars can do this, but it's those explosions that produce a huge chunk of all the elements in the periodic table. So all of that is produced in supernovae and nowhere else. So if you are wearing gold or silver or platinum jewellery, every single atom in that item was made inside a supernova explosion, probably several different supernova explosions that took place before the solar system had formed. All that stuff spread back out into space. Eventually, it comes together again to form clouds like this. This is the famous Pillars of Creation in the Eagle Nebula. Inside these clouds, gravity gets a hold, starts to collapse. The densest parts form stars. They start to shine again. As they do that, they burn away their surroundings. This is an actual Hubble image of a newly formed star in the Orion Nebula, and you can see it's surrounded by a disk of dark debris. This is an artist's impression of what that might look like close up. There's the star. There's the debris. And here we go. We think in those disks, this is where planets form. So these cycles of star formation. So that's where the stuff that made us come from. We are literally made of stardust, which I think is a pretty cool thing. So that's how we ended up where we are today. Here is the modern solar system. 8 planets, not 9, of course. Pluto, not demoted, reclassified. Pluto doesn't care whether we call it a planet or a dwarf planet. It's been there 4.5 billion years. It really, really genuinely doesn't care. I think it's quite exciting that we've discovered that there's something different and unusual about it, and that there are other objects similar. It's not just the last piddly bit at the end of the solar system. It's actually the start of a whole new regime of the solar system that we really didn't know about until a couple of decades ago. So I'm an optimist. There we go. But in that solar system, there's only one planet that exists in this sweet spot, because it's all very well having all the right ingredients for life, but you've also got to have the right conditions. And as I'm sure you know, it's called the habitable zone or the Goldilocks zone. It's the just the right distance from the sun where the ambient temperature is between 0 degrees centigrade and 100 degrees centigrade. So water exists as a liquid, not as a solid, not as a gas. And we're the only planet that's in that zone. This is a bit simplified because there are other ways that you can make your temperature a bit more balmy by having the right kind of atmosphere. But in our solar system, right now, we're the only place that's in that zone. And here are our two neighbours, Venus and Mars. Venus, almost exactly the same size as the Earth, shrouded in this thick carbon dioxide atmosphere. And Venus is too hot, and Mars is too cold. So all the water that's left on Venus is now vapour in the atmosphere, and there's not much of that. And all of the water on Mars is now ice buried in the soil or locked into the polar ice caps. So they don't enjoy the same balmy conditions that we do. And here, obviously, is the Earth right in the middle. All of this water, water, water everywhere. But that's not the only problem that we face. Okay, we're at the right distance from the sun, so the temperature is right. But the sun also does nasty things that are harmful to life. And this is a picture taken during a total solar eclipse where the moon blocks the sun, and you can see that the disk of the sun is surrounded by this glowing halo, what we call the solar corona. And the sun is constantly spitting out not just light and heat, but also a stream of charged particles that blast out through the solar system. And sometimes they come out in enormous bursts. We have these coronal mass ejections. You've probably heard they've been in the news quite recently. The sun's quite active at the moment. They can cause all sorts of problems for satellites in orbit. Imagine you're in an electronic circuit and a massive blast of high-speed protons with electric charge hits you. It's not going to be pleasant for you. And they're also bad for living things. When these coronal mass ejections come through, astronauts in the International Space Station retreat to a specially shielded part of the station because these particles can damage DNA, and that does all sorts of things. Obviously, it's not good for cell function. It can also lead down the line to things like cancer. However, just like in Star Trek, we have a magic force field, except it's not magic. It's a magnetic force field. The Earth's core, the outer core, is the core is made of iron. The outer core is liquid, and as that as the Earth rotates, that liquid iron is spinning, acts like a dynamo, and it produces a magnetic field. And that magnetic field protects us from the sun's harmful particle wind. Some of it does seep down along the magnetic fields, and as you can probably guess, it comes down over the poles, and it produces these beautiful aurorae. Because there's not very much of it that gets through, the atmosphere does a pretty good job of soaking it up. And what you're seeing when you see this glowing light show in the sky is atoms and molecules in the atmosphere absorbing those particles, and then they release the energy as different coloured light. Green is, I think, oxygen. You get blue and red from nitrogen. Okay. I'm going to take us back in time, 4.5 billion years, to the formation of the solar system. So we saw how solar systems form, how the planets form in the debris disks around those young stars. This is that planet formation process, really quite violent. Things stick together, dust grains stick together to form pebbles, pebbles stick together to form boulders, boulders stick together to form asteroids, asteroids stick together to start forming planets. And the first part of the history of the solar system, very, very violent. The Earth, the forming Earth, would have been covered in a magma ocean, would have been a very, very unpleasant place to be. And one of those collisions towards the end of that process was spectacular. There were more planets forming than there was room for them, if you like, in the solar system. And there was a planet, we think, in an orbit very similar to the Earth. It was about the same size as Mars. We call it Theia, after the goddess who, in mythology, is the mother of the moon, because these two planets, Earth and Theia, collided. The cores merged together, and a lot of the crust was blasted off into space, condensed in orbit to form the moon. So the biggest bang in the history of the Earth, anyway, and you can see evidence of it pretty much any night when you look up. It is the moon. We're now pretty sure that this is what must have taken place. It all kind of fits together. And the moon is actually quite a helpful thing for us to have. You all know, I'm sure, that the Earth is tilted on its axis as it goes around the sun. That's what gives us our seasons. But like a spinning top, actually, the axis of the Earth wants to wobble And it does a bit, and that actually is one of the causes of ice ages over thousands of years. But it wants to wobble and tilt. And if it did that, you can imagine that our seasons would not be particularly regular. And over decades or hundreds of years, you'd go from what our current tilt is, 23.5 degrees. I don't know if you can read that, doesn't matter. But it could, in a matter of centuries, it could tilt like this. In fact, it could tilt so that the pole was along the plane of the orbit and then tilt back again. And you could go from a scenario over several thousand years where at some point the pole is pointing directly towards the sun. At other points, the axis is absolutely vertical, 90 degrees, and you've got no seasons at all. And so Britain could go from being a desert to being completely polar in just a few thousand years. I think that would certainly make the evolution of life on this planet difficult, and certainly it would have made it go in a different way than it has done. So the moon actually stabilises that. It acts as a kind of a brake and stops the Earth from wobbling as the two systems are coupled together. The moon also does something else which may have been quite important in our evolution, because it causes the tides. Okay, the sun causes about a third of the tides, but the other two-thirds is because of the moon. So we wouldn't have such extreme tides without the moon. You can see here the difference that it makes. In London, in Greenwich, we're very aware of it. The River Thames goes up and down by 5 metres twice a day. It's pretty impressive when you think about it. Huge amounts of water sloshing around in the Earth's ocean basins because of the gravity of the moon. And some evolutionary biologists think that it may well have been those intertidal zones that encouraged life to move from the oceans onto the land. So without the tides, perhaps there'd be nothing on land, living on land. Difficult to say for sure, but certainly we might have the moon to thank for us being here. So we've got all the ingredients for life. We've got our energy source, we've got liquid water, we've got organic chemicals, and crucially, we've got a place in the solar system where conditions are nice and balmy, the temperature's right, we're protected from extreme radiation, the moon is stopping us flipping around all the time. And life did form, according to the fossil record, quite early on. Bacterial life got started, as far as we can tell, pretty much as soon as the conditions on Earth had settled down, the temperatures had dropped, the oceans had settled out. But for most of the Earth's history, billions and billions of years, life remained single-celled, bacterial, quite simple, living in the oceans. Why did it take so long for it to turn from that into the complex plants and animals, the complex ecosystems that we have today? Well, I'm not a biologist, and I don't claim to be an expert in this, but I think one of the reasons that it took so long might be, again, because of the sun. And this is the sun in visible light. That's what we're familiar with seeing. Obviously, don't look at the sun directly, and certainly never through a telescope or binoculars. It will damage your eyesight, but through filters, this is how you can see it. But it also gives out a huge spectrum of other wavelengths. And in particular, as we all know, it gives out ultraviolet light. We know ultraviolet is bad for us because it gives us sunburn, it can cause skin cancer. And this is why, because again, those high-energy ultraviolet photons, they get absorbed by DNA molecules in your cells, and the energy, when it's absorbed, damages the bonds, damages the molecules, breaks them, essentially. That's why it's bad. So ultraviolet is raining down from the sun, and the atmosphere of the early Earth was transparent to ultraviolet light. It was mostly nitrogen, carbon dioxide, things like that. You can shine ultraviolet light straight through that. It'll go straight through and hit the ground. And I think that might be one reason why it took multicellular life so long to get started. Because if you shine ultraviolet light onto a pool full of 100 bacteria, if 90% of them die, it means there's still 10% of the bacteria that are alive and that they can go on and reproduce. If you have an organism made of 100 cells, all of which are interdependent, if you shine ultraviolet light on it and 90% of the cells die, the organism dies. So I think there might be something in this. And it's only, so here's where the problem's coming from, it's only quite a long time after life has got started that one enterprising type of microbial life, the cyanobacteria, come up with a really great innovation. They, before that, all life has been using chemicals for its energy source. The cyanobacteria invent a chemical called chlorophyll, which they can use to extract energy from sunlight. And as a byproduct from that, they produce huge quantities of oxygen. And this is incredibly toxic to most of the other life forms. And so this is the first time that life on Earth has poisoned the atmosphere. And it took a while, but this process is adopted and kind of adopted by more complex organisms. So it's still the same process that takes place in plants. Eventually, so this is what's going on, sunlight comes in, And the plant uses, traps it in the chlorophyll, uses the energy of the sunlight to combine carbon dioxide and water to produce glucose, which is its food, and produces oxygen. And one form of oxygen is ozone. Once oxygen had built up to a particular level in the atmosphere, it formed an ozone layer, and as you all know, ozone blocks ultraviolet. So you had to have time for that to take place before complex life could really have a chance to get going. And here it is. Here is the Earth, with its complex ecosystems, its plants, its animals. Here are two of those rich ecosystems, the rainforest, coral reefs. Life has changed the Earth. It's everywhere. It's changed the atmosphere. It's colonised the oceans. It's colonised the continents. There are living things several kilometres down inside the rocks. There are bacteria that spend all their time living in droplets of water in the atmosphere. Life's all over the Earth. And you can see how life has changed the planet. This is the Earth of about 300, 350 million years ago. You can see it was undergoing quite a drastic ice age, huge polar caps. But at the equator, it was still quite balmy and tropical. And this is what it looked like. All sorts of amazing things, and giant dragonflies, tree ferns and things like that. The oxygen level was much higher in the atmosphere than it is today. And as all that collapsed and decomposed, it formed coal beds, and that's why this part of the world now was the crucible of the Industrial Revolution, that trapped sunlight in the plant remains that was then burnt in the 18th, 19th and 20th centuries to drive our society forward. So it all connects together. Now, there's another way in which we're still connected to the rest of the universe. I don't know if you can see this. Can you see these little streaks of light? This is a long exposure fisheye lens of the whole sky taken during one of the regular meteor showers that takes place throughout the year. And this is when the Earth is bombarded by tiny specks of cometary dust that burn up in the atmosphere. But of course, from time to time, bigger things hit our atmosphere. And in fact, we saw just earlier this year the huge lump of rock that came down over Russia. So they can be quite big things. And very, very rarely, but still from time to time, enormous things come down. So this is way, way after the formation process of the Earth, but there are still big chunks of stuff out there. And from time to time, they do hit the Earth. And this is the very famous one. As we heard earlier, I couldn't decide whether I wanted to be an astronomer or a paleontologist, but actually the two subjects do come together. Because we think that it was an asteroid impact, an asteroid about 10 kilometres across 65 million years ago, which certainly delivered the coup de grace for the dinosaurs. Here we go, artist's impression, obviously not a real photo. I wish. But quite a good one. You can see this object has hit the Earth travelling at probably 10 or 20 kilometres per second, weighing millions of tons. All of that kinetic energy, if you remember back to school, kinetic energy is half the mass times the velocity squared. So we've got a lot of mass, a lot of velocity, and that velocity is squared. When it hits the ground, that kinetic energy turns to heat. The asteroid is vaporized. Quite a lot of what it's landed on is vaporized. A flash, intense flash of light, causing forest fires for thousands of kilometers in every direction, and a shockwave blasting outwards supersonically. Really quite devastating. Global effects. Supersonic shockwave, we think it struck over the ocean. It would have driven tsunamis 100, perhaps even 300 metres high through all the ocean basins of the world, and when they hit land, they would have rolled for hundreds of kilometres inland, much worse than anything we've ever seen in our lifetimes. Debris would have rained down from the explosion site, causing secondary fires all around the globe. And then, worse still, the dust from the impact spreading in the upper atmosphere until the Earth would have looked a bit like that picture of Venus I showed you, completely shrouded in dust. Temperatures on the surface would have dropped for several months, probably a year or so. All the food chains on Earth would have collapsed. Plants would have stopped photosynthesizing. A complete ecological disaster. Eventually, the dust settles and we see this layer of clay, which has, it's called the KT boundary layer, and it's very rich in iridium, a metal which is very rare in crustal rocks on the Earth, but very abundant in meteors, and this is one of the first clues that this is what had happened, because that iridium's found all around the world at the top of the dinosaur-bearing rocks. And then we see things start to recover, because we see a huge spike in fern spores in the fossil record, and we know from volcanic islands and things like that ferns are often the first plants to recolonize devastated areas. But as things start to get back to normal, the Earth has completely changed, because 70% of all species have become extinct. And this is the sort of the dominant flora and fauna before the impact. And these are the descendants of what survived. Those 30% of animals and plants that through sheer luck, just happened to have qualities that allowed them to survive that period, or just happened to be far enough away that they weren't harmed too much by it. And of course, we are part of that lucky 30% because we survived. If that asteroid hadn't hit, we probably wouldn't be here. And space still influences life on Earth to a large degree. Many birds use the stars, the Milky Way, the moon to navigate on their migrations. Coral, again, I'm not a biologist, so I'm not claiming to be an expert in this, but I understand from watching David Attenborough that coral reefs, the Great Barrier Reef, they time their spawning. All sorts of different species time their spawning to particular phases of the moon, particularly full moons. And I think that's to do with catching the most favourable tide to help their eggs and sperm mix and spread widely. So there you go, they time for the full moon. Turtles time their egg-laying behaviour according to phases of the moon. I understand that seals use the stars and the moon to navigate when they're out at sea. And just quite recently, actually, there was something in the news about dung beetles, who they actually use the Milky Way to navigate. For a dung beetle, once you've got your ball of dung, the most important thing to do is to run away with it as far away from where you found it in a straight line to get as far away as fast as possible so that another dung beetle doesn't steal it. And the way they do that, because they work at night, is they use the band of the Milky Way to align themselves. And so they just keep going at the same angle to the Milky Way. And they've tested this, like, in a planetarium, I think. So even beetles use the stars to hide their balls of poo. Because we orbit at an angle, the climate changes as the Earth orbits around the sun in a very regular fashion. And so the next time you look at this, and then 6 months later you look at this, or you see this and this, that is because of the astronomical accident of the way the Earth formed and the way that it is tilted in space. So astronomy is influencing just something as basic as the seasons. The seasons happen because of the Earth's position in space. And the story doesn't end there, because, of course, we're still going to be affected by things in space. So I thought I would kind of wind up a little bit by looking ahead, and this is my sort of forecast of all the sorts of nasty things that we might have to look forward to. Isn't that great that science allows us to have more knowledge of things that we can be frightened about? But I'd rather know than not know. Of course, there are still big lumps of stuff out there in the solar system, and this is a brilliant poster that we had designed for an exhibition we did a couple of years ago at the observatory about comet and asteroid impacts. I think I've been having a particularly tough week at work when I described to the designers what I wanted. They also did another version of something similar coming right down over London, and it looks like it's heading right for the Olympic site in Stratford. If something like that happened, it could be devastating. We saw earlier this year the effects of something actually quite small, just a few metres across, a few tens of metres across, that didn't even hit the ground. It exploded in the atmosphere. But it caused a lot of damage and actually injured people. Bigger things do strike. We know that they strike from time to time, every few hundred years. Luckily, in recorded history, none has happened over a populated area. The Earth is quite big. Actually, populated areas are not a large fraction of it, and two-thirds of it, of course, is water. But if one of these things did happen over a populated area, it could be quite devastating. And here are two beautifully macabre, I think from the 1950s, pictures by the wonderful space artist Chesley Bonestell. And this is an object about 50 or 100 metres across, exploding several kilometres above Paris. And you can see the city's on fire, and the shockwave is just coming down and demolishing Notre Dame. And here is a similar-sized object which actually has made it all the way down to the ground, right in the middle of Manhattan. And you can see the whole city is completely devastated. These things really are quite nasty. They pack a lot of energy, and when they hit, that energy is released in the form of heat. And of course, there are bigger things out there as well. And if a kilometre-scale object the size of the, sort of the dinosaur killer hit today, or maybe tomorrow, let's enjoy the dinner first. This is what would happen. Most of our populations live quite close to the sea for various reasons. Those tsunamis, I love disaster movies, so it was quite easy to find some great pictures of enormous mega tsunamis. This, of course, is from Deep Impact, which is a favourite film of mine. But they would sweep in hundreds of kilometres inland, utterly devastating. But then, of course, after that, we would have the impact winter. This is another wonderful Chesley Bonestall picture. This is Rio de Janeiro 6 months after impact. The sun has not shone for 6 months. It has been snowing for 6 months. Even if they were on the other side of the world from the impact, they've run out of food. We don't have food supplies to feed 7 billion people for a year without agriculture. It's completely devastating. Here's a lovely picture of London under metres of snow. This is actually from the day after tomorrow, but you get the picture. It would be really quite unpleasant. I should say before I move on, this is one thing where we have thought about mitigation strategies and things that we could do if we detected something coming towards us. And in fact, the first thing is what we're doing right now, which is trying to map every large object that's out there. And actually, we've mapped the large ones. We're now bringing the scale down and going down to sort of hundreds of metres and down to tens of metres to get a catalogue of what's out there and how it moves, to see whether there's anything that has our name on it in the next few centuries, which is about as far ahead as you can sort of predict. So don't worry too much. We haven't found anything yet that poses a danger in the next few centuries. And if we did, we have some ideas about what we might be able to do about it. Something we couldn't do anything about, though, would be a nearby supernova. We saw how, in some ways, supernovae were the crucibles of life because they produced all of the elements that we need for living things. But if one happened too close to us, it would be devastating. The huge blast of high-energy radiation would completely overwhelm the Earth's magnetic defences. It would strip away the ozone layer and everything on the surface would be exposed to nasty high-energy electromagnetic radiation and also the stream of high-energy particles from the supernova. So, and again, a lovely Chesley image there of a devastated Earth. However, I can tell you that there are no stars that could possibly go supernova within a dangerous distance of the Earth. So that's absolutely something that we don't have to worry about, at least for a few million years until our orbit has taken us into a different part of the galaxy. And it seems as though, over the whole history of the Earth, nothing like this has ever happened too close to us anyway. There are some people who have ideas that perhaps supernovae could explain some of the mass extinctions, but I think that's still very, very controversial. So don't worry about that one, please. But there is a catastrophe that we cannot escape. And we now understand very well how stars work. Stars are quite easy to model, at least their basic properties. And by observing stars throughout the galaxy, we now have a very good idea of the life cycle of a star. We saw how stars form from condensing clouds of gas. And once they formed, they actually live quite stably, cheerfully, creating new elements by nuclear fusion inside their hearts. And they go into this stable phase, which lasts, for a star like the Sun, about 10 billion years. And our Sun is about 5 billion years old, so we're about halfway through this lifetime. But eventually, the Sun will run out of hydrogen fuel, and it will then, in 5 billion years, enter a new phase of its life. And you can see here, it's going to get big. We call it a red giant. This is the Sun now. This is the Sun in 5 billion years' time. It will swell up to 100 times its current size. How big is that compared to the Earth's orbit? Well, the Earth's orbit is about there. So it will definitely swallow Mercury. It will definitely swallow Venus. Will it swallow the Earth? Not entirely sure, because one of the things, as it swells up, actually, paradoxically, it will actually lose some material, it will blast some material away, and so it will actually become slightly lighter, so its gravity will weaken, and so the Earth's orbit will actually widen a bit. But whether we're swallowed or whether we just go on hanging on just outside the atmosphere of the Sun, it's not going to be good. Here is the Earth in 500 million years' time, when the Sun is still very similar to today, but gradually over the next few hundred million years, the Sun will slowly start to brighten. And eventually it will get to the point where the Earth's biosphere is unable to compensate for the increasing radiation. And at that point, it will enter a runaway greenhouse effect. And so over the subsequent billions of years, as the Sun gets gradually brighter, the oceans will start to recede and evaporate. Life on land will become impossible. Eventually, it will become impossible in the oceans as well. The oceans eventually will evaporate. The Earth will have a thick, soupy atmosphere like Venus. And then, even then, as the Sun becomes bigger and brighter, the atmosphere itself will be burnt away into space. And this is my final weather forecast for the Earth. that's what we have to look forward to. And my only, the only thing I can say to compensate slightly, well, as the sun expands, life on Earth will become impossible, but just possibly, briefly, in the final phases of the solar system, perhaps as the sun gets bigger, the habitable zone will move outwards, and perhaps for a while conditions might become more balmy on Mars, perhaps on Jupiter's moons like Europa, perhaps even on Saturn's moon Titan. But that's just a brief consolation, because eventually the red giant sun will do this, it will start to shed its outer layers, and life in the solar system will be over, it will be frazzled to a crisp. And all I can say is it will at least look very, very pretty. However, I want to end on a positive note, because something truly, truly wonderful and remarkable has happened in the last 10 or 15 years or so. For centuries, ever since Copernicus and Galileo, people have understood that the Earth is a planet going around the Sun, and that the Sun is a star. And they've wondered if the other stars in the sky also have planets going around them. In our lifetimes, for the first time ever in human history, we have been able to answer that question. And the answer that's come out just in the last year or so, really, is yes, pretty much every star in the sky has planets going around it. And some of those planets are really weird and wonderful, like nothing in our solar system, which is a complete surprise. We thought we were normal. It turns out we're not necessarily normal. But the next time you look up at the night sky, do it tonight if it's cloud-free, you can say for sure pretty much every one of those stars has its own family of planets going around it. And I think that's a really amazing thing to be able to know. Of course, the question is, how many of those planets are like the Earth? We have, or we had until quite recently, an amazing telescope up there, NASA's Kepler mission, which was scanning the sky, looking for signatures of planets. It has finished its primary mission, so it's done what it set out to do, and it was sort of going on an extended mission. It's suffered some inevitable failures now, and the engineers are still trying to decide if they can bring it back online. But it has already done what it set out to do. It's produced enough data for scientists to study for years. But it was designed to detect Earth-sized planets in Earth-like orbits, so Earth-sized planets in the habitable zone of their star. So the question is, how many Earth-like planets are out there? And we don't have a final answer yet, but in the next few years, I think that we will have. And the indications are it could be quite a lot. So the sky is full of brave new worlds. And this is very exciting. This is one of the first, most of those planets are detected indirectly. We don't see them, we see the effect they have on their star. But a couple of them have been detected independently. Here is a Hubble picture of a star, Fomalhaut actually, quite a famous star, visible to the naked eye. They have blotted out the star, and in this sort of this scattered light, which is just starlight that's been scattered by the optics of the telescope, they found this tiny dot, and they saw over a period of years it moved. This is a direct detection of starlight being reflected by the planet itself. And now that we can start to actually see the light from those planets, we can start to do really cool stuff. We can take this light and we can split it into a spectrum. And when we do that, and we examine the brightness of each of the colours in the spectrum, we can look for the spectral signature of particular atoms and molecules in the atmosphere of the planet. We do that for the Earth, and we have done it for the Earth. You see things like carbon dioxide, quite a strong signal. You see H2O, water. You see O3, ozone, oxygen. You see methane. If we can start to see oxygen, water, methane in the atmosphere of a planet, that is a very, very strong signal that that planet has some kind of biochemistry going on. So things like this, cyanobacteria, perhaps even trees. And so at the moment, what we're hearing about in the news is this plethora of exoplanets. In the next couple of decades, perhaps what we'll be hearing about is exoplants. We almost have the technology to be able to detect these things if they are out there, and I think that's tremendously exciting. So the next time you look at something like this, just imagine you could also be looking at something like this. And I want to end now just on a note of inspiration, going back to that exhibition which has taken up all of my life for the last 6 months. The ad digital team produced this really lovely little trailer advert for it, which I wanted to show you because it's just very beautiful. You can't really read it. It says, "Mystery creates wonder, and wonder is the basis of man's desire to understand." That was Neil Armstrong. here are some lovely pictures of Buzz Aldrin on the moon. To confine our attention to terrestrial matters would be to limit the human spirit. I love these pictures. To think that we can go into space, again, really the first generation in history to do that. We've lingered long enough on the shores of the cosmic ocean, we're ready at last to set sail for the stars. That's Carl Sagan, of course. And the sky is the ultimate art gallery just above us. That's attributed to Ralph Waldo Emerson. It's human nature to stretch, to go, to see, to understand. Space as a planet, it has people in space. We've left the Earth, but it also has the Hubble Space Telescope. I think one of the most important scientific instruments ever made, because it has completely transformed our view of the universe. So if you are in Greenwich over the summer, please do come and see the exhibition, and please do let me know what you think. Thank you very much. I've completely eaten into your tea and coffee time, so I'm happy to take questions, but I will not be offended if you prefer tea to me. I know I would.
Sorry, we only have time, I'm afraid, for one question.
Right.
Please, just one very quick, good question. Take the gentleman in the blue shirt there. I don't think you've asked a question today. No, just in front, sorry, I'm afraid.
Thanks very much. Could you just bring us up to date briefly on what are our possibilities for deflecting large objects that we don't want to hit us at the moment? Do we have anything in the arsenal?
Yes, Bruce Willis is the... he would be the first choice. But if he's not available, I mean, the obvious thing that we all think of is trying to blow it up. And there's been quite a lot of work done over the last few decades trying to understand the composition of asteroids and comets. We know what they're made of, but what is their internal structure? And it seems like a lot of them are actually quite fragile things. And so blowing them up probably isn't necessarily the best thing to do, because what you might end up doing is just smashing them into bits that are still coming towards you. And there's a bit of a debate about whether it's worse to be hit by one big object or actually lots and lots of little ones, because ultimately the same amount of energy is being dumped into the Earth's atmosphere. And so it's a little bit unclear, but it's likely that the climate effect could be just as bad from lots of small objects as one big one. So I wouldn't go with blowing it up unless, you know, that's your last resort. There are all sorts of other ones. Some of them are quite sweet. We could try, given enough time, we could try towing it out of the way. It's not balmy. If you've got centuries, you fly a spacecraft to it, land it on the surface, kind of strap a rocket onto it, and actually use the material of the asteroid or comet as fuel and blast it out of the way. Some other ones I like are sending a fleet of spacecraft with giant parabolic mirrors to reflect beams of sunlight onto the surface, which cause the surface material to evaporate and actually produce a reaction effect and push it. If you've got centuries or decades, you don't need to give it much of a nudge to make it miss the Earth. The Earth is quite a small target. And then one I really like is exploding a spacecraft full of reflective paint in the path of the thing. So it goes through, it gets covered in this reflective paint, and then just the pressure of sunlight bouncing off the reflective surface pushes it into a new orbit, which I think is very lovely and very gentle, and not the sort of thing that you would ever catch Bruce Willis doing. So yes, there are lots of different ideas and lots of technology that we could develop. One thing very interesting, I talked to an astronomer who works on this all the time, and I said, what do you think we should do? And he said, the first thing we should do is track these things, identify all of them, find out where they are. The last thing we want to do at the moment is develop the technology to change their course, because if you can change the course of something away from the Earth, you could also change it towards the Earth, and it becomes a really nasty weapon of mass destruction. So let's not put that into our arsenals unless we actually know that we need it. So there you go. But my solution would be to paint them.
Thank you very much for that. That was amazing.
Thank you for listening to this special podcast brought to you by The Pod Delusion. You can find out more about The Pod Delusion on our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can also listen to our weekly programme.